Museums are often seen as custodians of memory, but also as civic spaces. How can museums begin to adopt regenerative mindsets or strategies? How can they start engaging better with communities? Welcome to Museum Chill, a podcast with the International Council of Museums, where we explore the evolving role of museums in shaping our societies and our shared futures. In this special edition series, recorded during the 27th ICOM General Conference, which is why you might be listening to audio behind us, we have the incredible privilege of gathering around museum thinkers and change makers who are diving into conversations that bring culture, community, and the planet we all share. Today, I'm joined by Adib Dada, regenerative advisor, architect, and forest maker, and the founder of The Other Dada. We'll be exploring what regeneration really means, how it can shape our cities and cultural spaces, and what lessons museums can draw from nature's ability to restore, adapt, and thrive. And now, welcome and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
From what I've seen, your work and philosophy center on regenerative strategies. For those who might not be familiar, could you unpack what regeneration means?
Sure. Regeneration is about restoring our relationships with the ecosystems that are around us. And it's about creating a positive impact. So it's moving away from a mind frame of scarcity and a mind frame where we are, you know, essentially just doing less harm. Like, you know, with sustainability, a lot of the time the sustainability talk is about, oh, we reduced, you know, energy by this much and CO2 and, you know, water. And it's all about just kind of like this reducing. So essentially just doing less harm. And what I'm interested in is how do we actually do good and how do we actually make positive impact? And that's, for me, what regeneration is about. So imagine a building that, if we were to call a building regenerative, that for me would mean, is it designed locally with local materials that are not being shipped away halfway across the world? Is it inspired from the local vernacular architecture and ecosystems and respectful of the ecosystem that it's being placed in? And does it have a role actually in making or in restoring that ecosystem? Because a lot of the times where we're building, especially in cities, the ecosystems are either completely degraded or are completely gone.
Yeah.
So how can these buildings actually help in regenerating those ecosystems? How do you bring the human inhabitants alongside the more than human inhabitants, such as, you know, microorganisms and insects and birds and reptiles and what have you? And how can you create those shared spaces for all of them to thrive in the city? Because when you are, you know, when these more than human creatures are thriving, they're much more affected than us by the pollution, by everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And so when they're disappearing, that's a bad sign for us. But when they are thriving, that's a good sign for humanity, that we are living in a healthy environment.
Yes.
And reconnecting people with nature, or helping them understand that they are nature, or re-understand it, or remember that they are nature, for me is a key step in this work.
Where did you found inspiration to rethink how places were created and then start making a work towards regeneration?
I've always loved being in nature, ever since growing up in Lebanon during the war. Nature has always been kind of my place of refuge. When I studied architecture, I was always interested in, you know, in green buildings and sustainable buildings. But then slowly I started looking or kind of understanding it more from a place where these sustainability certifications, all of that, are again essentially about just doing a little less harm, and you're rewarded as to like how much less harm do you do. And what I was interested in is that kind of total opposite of like, you know, we're here to, you know, to do something that's good with a positive impact.
Yeah.
And I got interested in biomimicry, which is essentially design or innovation inspired from nature. So looking, as opposed to the Industrial Revolution, which was all about what can we extract from nature and how do we commodify nature, for me, like, you know, the biomimicry revolution is about what do we learn from nature, and then how do we put these lessons to use in, you know, in our built environment.
And how have you seen that introduced to culture? Because you've been talking a lot about buildings and how it involves communities, and museums, even if we don't think about it many times as the first instance, they are essentially first a building or first a space in whichever form, and then they include their communities. So how you've seen this regeneration in museums?
So the way that I see it, museums have a really sort of outsized role in terms of shifting the perspective and the mindsets of people. And you can do that through art, through the building itself, through the spaces around the building. So for me, it's all of it. How do you get the community involved even before they enter the building of the museum? Because a lot of people will not even cross that threshold.
Yes.
So how do you get them involved with these ideas, with these activities? Our work is always very community-oriented and participatory in terms of inviting the community to come and showing them the tools and the agency that they have in restoring these places and regenerating these degraded areas and taking over places that the system has deemed, you know, like left over or, you know, not good enough or not useful enough, and actually taking them over, reclaiming them and transforming them into public spaces that are not only for the human public but for the more than human as well. And so creating these shared spaces for the human and the more than human to thrive together in the heart of the city. So I think, you know, that the cultural institutions have the opportunity because, you know, yet they have those spaces, they're usually embedded, you know, in cities and in communities.
Yeah.
And so they have the, when people are going there, there's already in their mind, they're going with an open mind to this space. And that's where we can bring in these ideas that in other spaces, maybe they wouldn't be received as well.
What I find interesting what you're saying is that sometimes museums are the place where people come, which yes, but my question is maybe how do you get the community to come? Because one thing is the people that are from the outside excited about learning about something new that they learned that the museum was promoting, but what about the community at the place?
So that's where, again, by learning from local culture, it's, you know, looking at where you're embedded and you're looking at what is the impact of that building on its surrounding ecosystem. And that ecosystem includes the human ecosystem as well. So it includes the, you know, the human culture. What is the neighborhood? What is it about? What does the community care about? And a lot of times for me, the connection comes back through nature, at least that what I'm interested in pursuing. I see that a lot of the problems in the world stem from a disconnect from nature and humans thinking themselves as separate from nature. And so really, how do you reconnect them with nature without asking them to go, you know, find a natural place and go hike somewhere or travel somewhere? But how do you create those experiences within the city itself? And how do you enable them to have those experiences as opposed to like designing an experience, they come, they experience it, and then they leave? How are they part of that experience? Hands-on, taking part of regeneration work. So for example, at the Jamil Art Center, the pavilion we built 2 years ago that was launched for COP28 is called Tarabot Weaving a Living Forum. And for us, the challenge was that the Jamil Art Center had a sculpture park outside of their building that and an outdoor amphitheater that no one was using. And so when we came to study the space, it was like, okay, the whole space is made of concrete. There's a few trees, some grass, but the trees are very, you know, they're exotic species. The trees are very neatly trimmed. They barely provide any shade.
Yeah.
So there's essentially no shade in the area. And first thing you learn, like thinking biomimicry and all of this, it's like observing the local species. And none of the local species spend any time of the day outside. They're always hiding under the sand, under the trees. And they will only come out at night when the sun has subsided. So the first thing that is needed is actually shade and shelter. So shelter from the sun. And so that became our starting point for designing the pavilion. So the first thing we needed to provide was shade. When we spoke, the way that we work is that we work with not only with engineers, but we work with botanists, ecologists, bird specialists. So anyone who has, you know, that can bring this sort of ideas to life.
Yes.
And we determined with them that in that particular case, the Jamil Art Center, shade was a big issue, but also, you know, all the ground was concrete, so it's absorbing the heat and it's emitting the heat throughout the day. The soil is completely locked under this concrete pavement. So the first thing we did is that we opened up the concrete pavement and we started working on restoring soil. And this is where the Jamil Art Center called upon their community, which they had been involved with already, it's been a few years, and we started doing composting workshops and using the food waste from the cafe of the museum, from the restaurant of the museum, in order to turn it into compost with the community and then integrate it into the soil. So the first step was regenerating soil health. And then the second step was regenerating water. So we worked with, the museum already had installed machines that are called air-to-water generators. So they're pulling humidity from the air, condensing it, filtering it, and providing it as fresh water for their human visitors. So what we did is that we installed this machine, but we hacked it and we made it give up all of its excess water. Instead of it going down the drain, it actually goes to fill a big bird bath. So now we have our human-made, let's say, technology that we are giving as a generous act to the other creatures as well. So now you have insects, you have dragonflies that are coming back, you have birds that are coming, and even cats that are in the area, lizards that come and drink from that water. The other thing that we did is working then, as I said, on mitigating the sun, so providing shade and also using the power of the sun to power the lighting of the pavilion.
Yeah.
And finally, once you have healthy soil, water and energy, this is where we introduce the plants. And so we worked on researching the native plant species, the desert plant species, and restoring and planting those within the structure itself. So the underground part of the structure is dedicated to the microorganisms and the insects and the soil-dwelling creatures. And then the first maybe 2 meters is dedicated to the humans that are coming to use the space and enjoy being, you know, in this structure and being in the shade or picking some of the edible plants that we have planted.
Yeah.
And then above the 2 meters is everything that is dedicated exclusive to the more than human. So it's all planted with native trees and flowers and shrubs that will attract the insects, which in their turn will then attract the birds.
Yeah.
And so it's not about, you know, when we talk about interspecies habitats, it's not about inviting these creatures into your home, but it's about, you know, these buildings, they have so many different layers. There's, you know, the underground, the inside, the outside, above, on the sides. There are so many places to integrate the more than human, provide space for these other creatures to be able to also appropriate that space. And it's not a space that is only for human and machine.
Can you tell us more about what materials you used in it and how it was created?
Yeah, so with the Tarabot, what we wanted to do, because it was a temporary pavilion that was launched during COP28, we didn't want to build a pavilion that screams sustainability, but then at the end of the day get scrapped and sent to landfill. So we made sure that from the get-go the design was for it to have multiple lives. So first life on land in terms of regenerating life on land and hosting species on land. And the materials that we used are all locally innovated in the UAE. All of the materials we use are coming from the waste stream of the date palm industry, which is an important industry in the region. And so Desert Board is made from the cuttings of the date palm when the, you know, farmers cut it on a yearly basis.
Yeah.
Instead of this waste being landfilled or burnt, this company started collecting it and transforming it into an architectural material that can replace OSB boards and MDF boards and is non-toxic and is actually carbon positive because it's sequestering that carbon into a stable form.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have any toxic materials in it, so it's not leaching, you know, toxins into the indoor air. We also used psyllium panels that were developed from the mycelium panels. So mycelium, that's are the roots of fungi. So they were fed the cuttings or the shavings from that desert board while it was being processed. And we had, you know, then these panels act can be temporary walls and fixtures. But in our case, we used it as food source for insects that would come and start eating away at it. And then as the insects grow bigger, then the birds come and eat the insects. So as a way to regenerate the life. Another material we use is date form, which is made from the date pits, which are also again wasted and become very toxic in the environment. And so those are crushed and roasted like coffee beans, and they turn into this really beautiful, sweet-smelling material that that can be used. And we used as well local clay to make clay cones that we used for our passive cooling system. So all of these also create multiple habitats and multiple niches for different organisms to occupy, and that's why we call it an interspecies habitat.
With this in mind, you have found with your project so many options and substitutes to what may be used as building material. Do you have any examples of exhibitions or museums that have used this type of materials for creating their spaces?
Yeah, so turning on to Tarabot, the idea is that, you know, so we designed it for the first life. Now that it's about to take its second life in a few months, it will be dismantled. All these materials can then be composted in the ground and go back to feed the soil where they came from. And then the steel structure itself, because that was what was locally available, let's say, in the UAE. The steel structure itself, instead of being just recycled, is actually going to be transported into the sea to regenerate life underwater. So it's this idea of how do you design with regeneration in mind from the beginning, and it's not just an afterthought, and it's not just about recycling or closing the loop, but really augmenting, and for this pavilion to have multiple lives, so regenerating life on land as a first life, regenerating life underwater as a second life, as an artificial coral reef. So it becomes a coral reef and fish habitat restoration project. In terms of exhibitions that I've seen, one of our projects, Beirut Serverless Forest, is actually part of an exhibition at the Wellcome Collection in London, an exhibition called Thirst in Search of Fresh Water, created by Janice Lee. And what she did was pretty amazing. Her and her team only used materials in the exhibition that are coming from natural materials and from the waste stream. They went through about, I think, a year of testing and vetting to make sure that those materials are up to the standards of any other material that is usually used in museum settings that are usually inert or synthetic materials, plastics, and all of that. And they proved that these materials, when treated properly and naturally, they can actually withstand or surpass the performance of materials in a museum setting. So the whole exhibition is designed only with these materials. So I definitely encourage your listeners
to go. And what would you say about the museum professionals that might think like, oh, yes, but this, first of all, takes a lot of time, maybe, and it might be a huge budget to consider when it comes to reconsidering the structure, reconsidering the places?
So I don't agree with that, because it's there's a lot that you can do within a given space that already exists, like what we did with the Jameel Art Center. So there was just a new space that they hadn't been able to activate that we managed to activate. In the past, in less than 2 years, there's more than 40,000 visitors that have come through. That's human visitors, not counting the insects and all of that that have come back. And it's become a project, it's a placemaking project, even though that wasn't necessarily the intention at the beginning. But it really became so attractive for people, because having that spot of shade in that kind of like highly built up area already attracted a lot of people. And then having the sound of water and having passive cooling systems that we installed, all of it is done with local materials, all of it is done with material innovations that were created in the UAE. From waste that was diverted from the landfill. So it touches on all of these things of, you know, the UN SDGs and the ESG goals and the climate commitments and the climate mitigation and so many things. And you don't have to, you know, go big or do nothing at all. There are so many small interventions that we can do. The smallest forests we've planted are just, you know, a few square meters. The latest project we did in Beirut, we worked with a bank. So, like, you know, the kind of like capitalist, you know, representation, and it's, you know, we managed to convince them to give away one parking spot from their big parking lot, and we cut up the asphalt and came together with the chairman of the bank, the advisors, the bank tellers, the parking attendants, as well as the neighbors that are living nearby, to plant this together. So it became an activity that's a meaningful activity of the bank reaching out to its, you know, to its own team, but also to the community around it. Thanks to that project, now the parking is being opened on the weekends. They started hosting a farmer's market every Saturday. So these projects, even though they're very small, it didn't cost a lot of money. First of all, it created a really good bond between the bank and the neighbors and also within the employees themselves. It's something that they see on a daily basis. They see it growing. They see it starting to attract butterflies. They see it starting to attract birds. And it's had the impact that is much larger than just its, you know, 13 square meters of one parking space. It has transformed the understanding of their private space and how it can be turned into a public space at the times where the bank is not using it. And so the same can be done with these cultural institutions, with the outdoor spaces, with their parking lots, with any kind of remnant leftover space, you know. So we've worked on projects that are just, as I said, just a few square meters. So space is not an issue, budget is not an issue. It's just about having that, seeing that the future is not just in the hands of developers and designers and architects and engineers, but it's really also should also be in the hands of the community where these spaces are being built or where these spaces are operating. And that creates long-term lasting communication and real engagement with the community, both human and more than human.
And talking about the future, if we were to imagine a museum of the future that considers regeneration, what would it look like for you?
So for me, it would be a museum that is ideally not built from scratch. I like to talk a lot about adaptive reuse. There are so many structures that are, you know, in cities everywhere that are not being used, that so much money and effort and material and carbon, you know, has already been put into it. So how to creatively reuse those spaces instead of just destroying these buildings and building something new from scratch, or instead of destroying ecosystems and building something new in those ecosystems. So first, adaptive reuse whenever possible, integrating the community from the get-go in terms of what are their needs beyond just what the museum wants to offer. If you want to create a real partnership with the community that you're supposedly serving, but also looking at everything from the materials that you're using, you know, staying as local as possible, being inspired from the local system, local architecture, not just from a pastiche where, you know, we are just copying what was there before, but it's because our ancestors developed these architectures in a way that they had already been looking at nature and seeing how they can best adapt to the local conditions. So how do we learn from that? And how do we again think in this more inclusive and generous way about not only the human visitors and a certain kind of visitor, but everyone that is using the museum, whether that's the janitors, whether that is the employees of the museum, whether that's the community, everyone that is in going in and out of that or around that space, and really thinking also of the outside, however that outside space, however small that outside space is, how can it be put to the use? How can it be that first impression that people get that will attract them to get closer to the entrance and then eventually into the space itself?
Thank you for that. Our final question, can you share a song that you will listen to in a museum?
I really like the song by Fredrika Stahl. I think it's called You Can Make Change. It's from the soundtrack of a movie called Demain, Tomorrow, that came out a few years ago, that talks about the climate crisis, but the idea that all the solutions are all out there, and so they trap the world showcasing these solutions. It's a really beautiful film that's originally in French. It's a really beautiful film to watch, and very kind of hopeful, and the whole music and the whole soundtrack is incredible, but that song specifically makes me think of wanting to be in a museum and like seeing that you can be the change, like again having that agency and reminding people that they have the agency and they're not hopeless in the face of everything that's going on around us.
Adiv, thank you for this conversation and for helping us imagine a future where both cities and cultural spaces can give back more than they take. This episode is part of a Museums in Chile special edition series recorded around the Global Museum Gatherings, where we explore how creativity, care, and regeneration can reshape our cultural ecosystems. And as always, thank you for listening. Until next time, keep your curiosity alive and keep chilling with museums. International Council of Museums and our mission to support sustainable development, cultural heritage, and community engagement, visit icom.museum. Don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platform and social media to stay updated on future episodes in this series, where we will continue to explore how museums, art, and technology can shape a better, more sustainable world.